Hello and welcome to the Oxygen Addict podcast. We're brought to you every week by our sponsors, precisionfuelandhydration.com. You can personalize your fueling and hydration strategy so you perform at your best with 15% off your first order of electrolytes and carbohydrate fuel with the code OA23 at precisionfuelandhydration.com. Welcome to the show, everybody. I'm your host, Coach Rob Wilby, and every week we bring you an episode of this podcast to help motivate and inspire you. This week, we've got a fantastic interview for you with Ironman world champion, Sam Laidlow. Sam's been on the show two or three times before. He first came across my radar when he won the Lakesman back in 2019. And at the end of that interview, as kind of a throwaway half joke, I said to him, you have to come back on the show when you're Ironman world champion. And I reminded him of this after his win in Nice, and he was true to his word and he's come back on the show today. So it's an interesting interview. He talks about everything that he's been through in the run-up to the win and the controversy as well after the win with some of the allegations of doping that were thrown out at him, as well as talking about what the win means to him, how important it's been to his family, how he sees himself progressing in the sport into the future. And it's a really good interview, I think, to demonstrate how someone who has a vision for themselves all the way from being a young child can get all the way through life and finally achieve what they've really dreamed of. So yeah, I really enjoyed this interview. I think Sam's a great guy and I really appreciate him taking the time to come on the show. So a couple of things you can do for us, please. If you do enjoy this episode, please follow us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Click like and subscribe on YouTube if you're watching on the YouTube video. And secondly, if you find this inspiring and you decide you want to take that step and do your first 70.3 or even your first Ironman this year and you're looking for help with your training, I understand it can be difficult. I understand it can be worrying. And I know it's very, very challenging for people to know where to start with the training. I think we've got the best all-round system for busy age groupers who want to complete a 70.3 or an Ironman, but want to keep it running alongside a busy family life, a busy working life, keep all those plates spinning at once. If you want to find out more, we've got all the details on our website, which is team.oxygenaddict.com. And if you're interested in finding out more about how coaching can work for you, just click the link in the show notes, go straight to my calendar, and you can have a chat with me and we can talk you through how the process works and find out if you'd be a good fit for joining the team. So good stuff. So without further ado, I'm really proud to get onto the podcast this year's Ironman world champion, Sam Laidlow. How good does that sound, Sam?
Yeah, feels like it's been a long time coming. And it feels like it's been a long journey since that first Lakesman interview we did. So yeah, it's a pleasure to come back and to kind of, I guess I told you that I would come back and we talked about me becoming world champion and stuff. So it's close to my heart to come back on the show. Yeah.
Man, look, on a personal level, I really appreciate you sticking to your word and saying your word, because it was June of 2019 when I looked back that you came over and you raced the Lakesman. And I got a text from a mate of mine who'd won it a year or two before. And he said, you're not going to believe what's happening at the Lakesman at the moment. This dude's shown up and he's gone 8:19, I think you went, or 8:20, didn't you? And we got you straight on the show later on that week to talk to you. And I remember one of the things you said at the end of it was, my ambition is, and always has been, I want to be the Ironman world champion. And like, fair play to you. Lots of people say that they want to do that, but very few people actually back it up. And so it's an amazing story to come from that, your first Ironman at 20, to winning the world championships at 2024. So like, yeah. From all the listeners, congratulations. That's the first thing.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And it's funny because you said that lots of people say it, like they say, but actually very few people do say their ambitions. You know, I think can be a bit frightening, like taking the risk to say it out publicly, like what you really want. But generally most people that do, like, I generally think you can kind of predict what you're going to achieve, but you just have to have the confidence to express it and to tell the world what you're going to do. And and now I've kind of realized that actually the bigger that goal, the better, you know, because it's also quite difficult now being in a position where I'm 24 year old and suddenly I've achieved my lifelong goal, you know. So first time in my life I was a bit lost actually, and I wouldn't say that actually these like 2 or 3 months have been the easiest months of my life. Actually, you realize that going after something is actually way more, it brings you a lot more joy than actually having it. So the next step is some as big a goals as I could dream of, and whether I achieve them or not, we'll see. But the goal is to win 6 more of these things, and I'm quite open about it. I'm hopefully the greatest, but we'll see where this journey takes me.
So that was my follow-up question, is the what's next question. Is that what you want to do? Do you want to go and, obviously a couple of people have got 6 of them. Do you want to go and go one better?
Yeah. I mean, so initially, I think even in one of our podcasts, I got asked, like, what would I do if I did achieve that and stuff? And I always said that I didn't think I would go after more titles. I didn't think that was necessarily me. But then kind of taking a bit of a deeper dive into who I am and stuff after the World Champs, I actually realized that I am a triathlete, and I'm a child of the sport, and I enjoy searching for performance, and that's what brings me joy. You know, something that really makes me content is ending a good day of training. Now it's become pretty a cool journey, because I've built this small team around me. We just come back from Italy, where we had this kind of team building, there's 8 of us, and it's all part of this process. And yes, it's me performs, but for me, bringing this team to be the best in the world, dominate, that's really the goal, and that's what we're striving for. And it's an exciting prospect. We'll see. Yeah, as I said, it's been difficult. There was straight away one of the first things I was like, okay, because 4 years ago I wrote that I'm going to win Kona in 4 years or Cape Nice. Now I need to write the next 4 years, 10 years. Yeah, that's obviously what documentary was about, was the kind of last 4 years. So the first thing I did was like, okay, I'm going to win next year, the next year, the next year, the next year. And it was like, well, is that really what I want? And so more than the titles now, I want my goal in life to more be a lifestyle, because that's something that's like never actually paid. You know, it's something, if you just fix your goals on basically lifting a banner, which is the World Champs, it's quite difficult when you reach it, because the joy of lifting a banner maybe lasts a few seconds, and then that evening and you enjoy it. And then the next day you're like, oh wait, was that it? Was that everything like my whole life I've been gearing towards? So now it's more about really creating a lifestyle where me and my team seek the best possible performance. And I just hope the titles are an outcome of that, basically.
That's really interesting. I wanted to come around to the documentary, because I watched it a couple of times this week preparing for the interview. And I want to start at the end of the documentary, because it's a really interesting little bit. The last few minutes where looks like you go to the attic or something, and you produce this little wooden box. Will you tell us about the wooden box for the people who haven't seen the documentary?
Can I just say it's not at all staged. Like, so this wooden box is generally where my dad kept paper that 4 years ago when I'd moved back home, I kind of sat down with him and said, okay, I want to win Kona and work back from there. And I kind of took an hour or two to write down everything that I thought was important to win. I basically opened this box that I completely gone out of my mind. The first year I kind of kept thinking about it, and we had it on a wall. And then we kind of put it away when COVID hit. Obviously we thought that everything would kind of change, and for a while we didn't even know if Kona would be a thing, and then there was no racing, etc. So we put it to one side, and I kind of felt like, because as I said, one of my biggest goals was, like, when I was a kid, my parents would joke about me being kind of the youngest ever Ironman world champion. As I got older, I kind of felt like it was slipping out of my hands, and I didn't think it was quite feasible. We thought maybe with the COVID, it kind of pushed everything 2 years back, and that I might be able to win in another 2 years from now. All the stars aligned pretty much to a T. I did exactly what I wrote down on the paper. So yeah, it's pretty crazy.
So the piece of paper, for the people who haven't seen it, you kind of say, right, in year one, was year one you want to complete an Ironman? Or what's year one? I want to break 8 hours for an Ironman. Yeah. 'Cause it was a pretty lofty goal right from the off, wasn't it?
Yeah, so the first year I wanted to go under 8 hours. Second year, I think either I qualified for Kona, and if I qualified, I wanted a podium. I didn't want to go to Kona not having the level to podium. And that again, like even last year, I didn't really think about that, but I went to Kona just being like so overwhelmed. I felt lucky to be there and just raced and like, honestly, if I would have come ninth, that I would have been over the moon, you know, because it was just Kona for me. And that had been my dream. And obviously I came second there, and that was like, even though I'd led the race most of the way, I was so happy with what had happened on that day. And then, yeah, the following year, which was on the paper, it says that in 2023, I would win the Ironman World Champs, because 23 was my dad's and my lucky number. And, yeah, so as I said, just all the stars aligned, basically.
How much of a home advantage did you feel with the race being in France this year? Because I've often wondered whether, I've heard, like, I'm way back in the day, the year that Tim de Boom won in Kona was the year that the terrorist attacks had happened.
Yeah.
And I remember him talking about how all the way along the course, on the run course, people were shouting, "Go USA." There was a big sort of, you know, patriotic feeling. But he said, "I felt they were cheering for me because there was no one else from the USA there. And it lifted me and carried me through the marathon." And it's always stayed with me that I'd never considered the effect of a hometown course. But you see it in the Olympics, you saw it happen at London. How was that experience for you racing in France?
Yeah, I mean, obviously when it got announced that it was in Nice, originally I was like, it was difficult for me to swallow because it's as if like you'd been preparing for the Olympics your whole life, and then suddenly it felt like someone just said, "Okay, well, the Olympics don't exist anymore." That's what it felt like to me. But then I tried to see the opportunity in what had happened, and obviously the fact that it was in France. And then, yeah, Ironman invited me to Nice in January, actually, to announce that the race was going to go ahead in Nice. And I remember saying in an interview then that I felt it would be a very important moment for French triathlon, because until now we just had to be good basically at long distance. And yeah, I said I believe there could be three or four French guys in the top 10. Bearing in mind, before my second place last year, the best ever finish was like fifth place, and there'd been one. So yeah, and there was four French guys, all pretty young guys, in the top 10. And obviously we won the title. So I generally think this will inspire a lot of kids to kind of go straight to long distance. And you see it already, actually, because it just wasn't common, you know. And I think Frodeno he had that influence in Germany, and I reckon in not so long we'll see a very dense level of younger athletes in Germany, and maybe in 20 years or 15 years this might happen in France. But yeah, as for the advantage, I guess when I first came off the bike and had a 6-minute lead, everybody kind of knew my history, and it's kind of it's all in, or all out, I guess. And so of course they were cheering, but the chances of me winning were still relatively slim. And then as the laps went on, it just got crazier and crazier. And I didn't realize whilst I was running on the last lap, you see it a bit on the documentary and the coverage, there's like a whole swarm of people on scooters, bikes, everything just following me for like the last 5K basically. But in my head, I couldn't even see them, you know. I mean, you're in agony. Yeah, but definitely when even like the guys giving you water, you know, I think if there was an opportunity for them to give you like 10 milliliters more of water, they were definitely doing it, you know. That's not to say they were like not giving water to the others, but yeah, definitely felt a little bit of extra support. And it was a special day, because equally it's much easier to bring your friends and family to a local race.
Yeah. So when Ironman announced they were going to do the sort of rotation between Kona and Nice, I think a lot of people had the reaction you spoke of, which was like, oh, you know, this is different and it won't be the same. But having raced in Nice now, what are your thoughts on that regarding how that felt regarding or compared to how Kona feels?
Yeah, I mean, if you ask me, I hope after these 4 years, it goes back to only being Kona. I hope it's just a test, or that they find some way of maintaining Kona as a big event and still then, I don't know, changing the world championships. But I think Kona should still have its importance every year. I think Nice is a great course, but it doesn't suit me as much as Kona, if I'm being honest. So I'm excited to go back to Kona, and because I've grown up and built my athletic career around that race specifically, you know. So we'll see. And I know that, for instance, like Jan and stuff, they kind of, when it was announced that it was in Nice, they basically said, "Oh yeah, it's not for me, I'm too heavy," and this and that. But yeah, I just, for what you lose, for like, for me, biking is my strength. and I'm not a climber, you know, I'm one of the heavier guys. I'm like 77 kilos. And so on paper, I wasn't one of the best. And same with Magnus, he's like 80 plus kilos, and we shouldn't be the best guys. But what you lose on the climbing, you also gain because the bike is longer. You know, we're spending 4.5 hours on the bike, suddenly not 4 hours. So we've equally got more time to make a difference on the weaker cyclists. Yeah. I think course specifically suited Patrick, and he showed that, you know, he cycled very, very well. He has a very good power to weight. But yeah, I believe when we get back to the flatter roads of Kona, Magnus and me will make even more of a difference, similar to how we did in Roth, I guess.
Mm. And do you feel that obviously you grew up essentially as a cyclist on those kind of roads. There's some, let's say, challenging descents on that Nice course. And bike handling becomes a big part of it. And I feel as though there was a swing for a while towards, you know, just power-based cycling. The biggest number was going to win. But on the Nice course, the bike handling's definitely a big part of it as well. And it was obvious watching the video, your bike handling was really, really good going down those hills. Did you feel as though that was going to be an advantage to you?
When I got asked already, like in interviews before the race, how I felt about your course and stuff, I kept saying that it's not a course that suits me. It's just, I think it's a course that doesn't suit many triathletes, and that you'd get exposed if you didn't know how to ride a bike, basically. But I'm not an amazing bike handler. At handling a bike. Of course, I live in the Pyrenees and know how to go downhill probably better than somebody who lives in Denmark and can only go flat. So I kind of felt that. So I went there on camp twice before the race, kind of February, and then again in the summer after Roth, to check out the course. And it was kind of, everybody was seemed to be overthinking it a little bit. Like the descent was, it wasn't technical. It was just very rough. Like the road isn't very nice. So it was more about not losing your hydration, not coming off the bike, and that kind of stuff. So I really didn't try to take any risks. I think Rudy, who actually lives there, took some risks, but he went downhill faster than me, and gained probably a minute or so there. But yeah, it was a risk he was willing to take, and I wasn't. And yeah, so I know that, for instance, Magnus and stuff, he put like a dropper post on his bike and just did some crazy things. You know, I really felt like people were overthinking the weight situation and the downhilling and all this, because at the end of the day, like it's not a grand tour or like hilltop finish, you know, like we're still riding 40K an hour around this race. And there's a lot of parts where we're at 55 kilometers an hour. So if you've got the power and if you're aero, like, and you know approximately how to go downhill, I felt you would do okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And let's talk about the reaction then afterwards among the French triathlon community, because, you know, people who don't know the French setup, you've grown up racing in the French setup. And as you said, the French haven't had an awful lot of success recently, especially at long distance. Does it feel like things have changed after your win? How's it been received amongst the French people and your teammates?
Well, they've obviously, it's been received well. As I said before, like, we don't have a rich history in, I'm in the long distance triathlon, but we do have a decent history in short course, and just a few weeks later, Dorian Connick was world ITU champ. So that, that's great for the sport, but there's still a tendency, like, well, it's also linked because he's purely French and he has probably a French manager, I don't know, but it seems like on the French press and stuff, they talk more about that and there's documentaries and stuff. But I mean, I obviously have like half my following is French and half is international, I would say. So I also like do most of my interviews and stuff in English. So I'm happy to leave it that way. And slowly we might push. As I said, my manager is not French. So it depends a lot on these kind of, it depends a lot on these kind of things. I think it's more of a slow process, you know, and it needs to become like, it's the same with anything, you know, if one guy, like if one French guy wins a Formula One, it's not like suddenly everybody's watching Formula One in France. It takes a certain heritage, and a heritage is built up over years and years and years. So yeah, that's what Germany did with their rich history in Ironman. And in fact, it was quite, I went to the Selfish night in December, which is, I didn't really realize, I just thought it was a night, like an evening put on by Selfish, but it turns out it's actually much more like the German awards, basically, for triathlon. You really notice what a big Like there was like 700 people, just like fans of the sport, just came to basically see who would get the prize and stuff. And yeah, all sat down at dinner. And it's, yeah, I hope that we can go towards that, because I believe that it's a cool sport, and the goal is to make it cooler. You know, it can be boring to watch, I agree. And sometimes some of the race organizers don't necessarily make it exciting to watch, I believe. You know, when you watch a press conference in Ironman or in any kind of other triathlon, most of the time you just want to go to sleep. So trying to make it a bit more exciting. Definitely the PTO are trying to do that. Like we're kind of building characters and stories. But equally, it's on the athletes themselves, where you have to kind of do some work. You know, if that's what you're winning, like if you want to elevate the sport, there needs to be characters and heroes. And sometimes to do that, you have to kind of caricature athletes a tiny bit. You know, I'm not saying change them or put on a persona, but I'm just saying, yeah, caricature them very slightly.
Yeah. Okay. I wanted to ask you about the lead into Nice this year, because, and the documentary covers this really well, after your second place in Kona in October, it wasn't exactly the smoothest run-in for you, was it, leading into Nice this year? So talk us through a little bit the challenges that you had coming in with, you know, with Lanzarote and then with Singapore and all of that stuff. Because I think it's a very interesting journey you went on to even get to the start line.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, like we need to take it back a little bit to Kona, because obviously in Kona, I really went from being like nobody to suddenly everybody knowing my name in triathlon. And I signed with like the biggest brands in the sport before ever even winning professional race, you know. So I was in a very rare situation. So of course there was a built up pressure from me, and also from just natural from fans and partners. And so, yeah, I definitely felt a lot of pressure to really perform. And I felt like, okay, this is the year where I had to deliver, you know, because as I said, a lot of people investing in you. And yeah, I felt like I need to perform. And so I trained really, really well actually over the winter. I actually felt like I'd almost discovered a new gear from the confidence I got from Kona. And so I'd done probably the best like 4 or 5 months over the winter I'd ever done. And I went into the season happy with what I'd done, not necessarily confident, but happy, because I felt like I had stepped up a gear. And yeah, so started in Gran Canaria with half Ironman not really being my speciality, but the level was decent there and I won the race. So that was a good start. And around that time was actually, I think there was 3 weeks to Lanzarote. So then I went straight to Lanzarote or something, 4 weeks maybe. And around that time was where I had my best, that was peak of my physical capabilities of this year, really. Generally, I don't know, maybe some athletes might disagree, but I find it's quite difficult once you hit the season to kind of elevate your level again, unless you kind of come away from the racing and like do a proper 2 month block, you know? So because there's always traveling and then racing, traveling, recovering, etc. So yeah, leaning to Lanzarote, that's when I felt I was at my peak. And I like on paper, it looked impossible to lose Lanzarote. You know, we thought that, my dad and I thought that like I could cruise win with 10 minute lead. That's what we thought. And, but yeah, you can't be overconfident in this sport. And, I started feeling not too great 2 or 3 days before. And, I did some blood work there in Lanzarote, which actually cost me an arm and a leg. So I don't recommend anybody doing any kind of lab or COVID test or anything in Lanzarote. I found out that I had a liver infection, which we don't really know what was caused by. It could be bad food, it could be lake water, it could be anything. I felt okay for an hour on the bike, then just no energy. I kind of hobbled around until finished the bike. But obviously I'd set off at the power I wanted to, so I did an hour like where we thought I'd be, and then like suddenly just was completely empty. But you start anyway. I ended up DNF in that race after 20k on the run, and from the outside everybody's like, oh, he's overpacing it, like he's just trying to bat above his station basically. But deep down I knew I was capable of that kind of wattage on the bike and that kind of pace running. And and even when I look back at that now, when that's when I believe I had my best like shape of the year, best run shape specifically. And I just 2.5 hours on the bike, I've basically been like dying. And then I came off, I was like, okay, I'm going to start the marathon, see where this leads me. And I ran myself back into the lead and was like running at like 3:39, 3:40 minute kilometer pace for the first 20K. And then the lights just completely went out again. So somewhere like I kind of knew that there was like good shape in me. But of course you start having doubts. You're like, oh, because before that I'd only performed well over the Ironman distance in Kona. No other race had I not blown up pretty much. So yeah, it was step that was start running again. And it took me like two and a bit weeks to get over that liver infection, because it's just, you can't really absorb carbs like how you do. You kind of have to flush your system out, and it's just takes time, and it's difficult because it's not like a physical injury. So you're like, surely I can train. And so I'd keep going training and make it worse, and et cetera. So, and then suddenly I only had like 2 or 3 weeks left before Roth. And Roth was another main goal, of course. Then I arrived in Roth healthy, but I was just not trained. So we went some crazy speeds on the bike with Magnus, had like a 12 minute lead over third place. And then on the run after only like 10K already, my calf just pinged basically, because I wasn't trained enough, you know. And suddenly I'd just ridden a world record pace pretty much for 180K and started running at 3:45 minute kilometers pace. And so, yeah, something just said stop. But I felt so bad from Lanzarote that I felt the kind of pressure to finish, I guess. So yeah, I kind of hobbled my way around 30K. Yeah, finished. And I think I ran 3:05 marathon, but still did like seven, can't remember what time I did, but 7:40, I can't remember. Like I can't remember what time it was, but it's pretty insane time considering I ran a 3:05 marathon.
Would you like to go back to Roth when you're healthy and in shape? Was that a pretty amazing experience?
Yeah. I mean, for sure. It's crazy. Even like, obviously it's a very small town and all the pros kind of stay in homestays. And over there, like Jan Frodeno is like David Beckham, you know, he's like, it's insane. Like everybody's just in love with triathlon there. So yeah, of course I'd like to go back, sit healthy, and again, have a good battle with Magnus there. I believe Roth is kind of his thing and that he'll be very good there for a few years. Of course, yeah, that's definitely a bucket list race. So then after Roth, it was kind of took me again 3 weeks, I guess, of no running to get over my calf tear. It was a very small tear, so it was okay. And so then slowly built back up again. Went to Challenge London. Just as a kind of training race, and I had some error testing to do in the UK anyway. And then from there, could kind of see the trajectory going back up, and I thought, okay, maybe I could save some, because when I had this calf tear, I was like, oh, well, Nice's, it's done, you know, like I can do the race, but I'm not going to win it. But I could see it kind of upward trajectory, and it was kind of back in my mind. I was like, okay, well, maybe actually this could bring me some freshness, and I could be in decent shape, and maybe I can save a podium again, you know, at Nice. So build back up, because I hadn't raced on the PTO circuit the whole year, I was like, I felt quite fit, training was going well, and we kind of made a last minute decision to go to Singapore. On the way there, the flight was like delayed by pretty much 24 hours. So it took me like 2 days to get there. So 2 days, no training. I got there, trained for 1 day, like inside, then got COVID, got really ill. And so basically like tried to start the race, just wasn't in it. I was cramping already in the swim. At that point I was in like such a dark place, I guess, because I felt like I just completely messed up the season. That evening I just went on the piss.
Really,
like really, really hardcore with everybody else, like not knowing that I had COVID, obviously, otherwise, yeah. But everybody, I don't know, some like there was this stomach bug going around, there was just general sickness, and then there was COVID. So I don't know if I had all three or one of them, or so. But anyways, and I didn't test positive for COVID. You know, it was just me. I was just vomiting. So I thought it was a stomach bug, you know. But anyway, I went on the piss. Probably drank a bit too heavily, and I remember the next morning having breakfast with Gustav at a hotel, who'd also had a bad race and a difficult year, and we were just kind of both like, yeah, just basically expressing how we felt to each other, you know. At one point he asked me how I felt about Nice, and I basically just I'd given up on it, you know, pretty much given up on it. But I believe everything that happened up until then was kind of out to test me. And it kind of, in the end, if I overcame everything, I'd be all right. So then anyway, I flew straight from Singapore to Nice. And then I was like in a bubble basically for 3 weeks, just with my coach, my dad, and after my training partner came sixth, and the 3 weeks went really well. I did two or three like really decent sessions where again we thought actually maybe I could do something, but I didn't believe I could win. You know, although when I watched the documentary. So one of the last runs I did with Aftershock before the race, I was like, oh, you know, like if I do a top eight, I'd be happy. And I was like, come on, top eight in the world is good. And he was just, oh, just shut up. You know, so he could see the numbers and stuff that I was doing. And then now when I see the interviews of like everybody else around, like my dad, my mom in the documentary, it looks like they filmed the day after. They were so confident I was going to win, you know, and I didn't at all. I felt so far away from that, you know. So, yeah, it was fascinating to see that and to realize that actually it's the confidence that your team have around you that actually like get you to places.
Yeah. That's interesting you say that, because I did assume that that stuff was filmed after the race, and the fact that it was filmed before the race, they had no doubts at all.
Yeah.
That you were going to perform at the very least and probably win. Right.
Yeah. I mean, my mom was saying things like, oh, I think Sam needs to remember that he's got wings and that sometimes it's time to fly. And then just, there was so many, I said on that day, so many stars aligned. My dad said, similarly, he said that he thinks I can win. But yeah, I felt so far away from it. But it's always when you least expect it, you know, and just, you never know, you know, maybe if you just carry on working, whatever it is, not just draft, or if you just carry on working, you never know what could happen tomorrow. So, yeah.
And what was their reaction? Your mum, your dad, your brother, your girlfriend? I know you're a very close-knit unit. And that really comes across in the documentary, how it feels as though all of you won. It feels as though it was a genuine family. You know, you express it really well when you say, it's been our dream since I was 5 years old for me to win this. They're all part of it with you the whole way. It really comes across in the film.
Yeah. And it's pretty, I feel so grateful basically, because it's, my parents were both very accomplished people in their own rights, and then they invested everything into not necessarily creating a world champion, just invested everything into having a stable and loving family, you know. And they invested so much, they invested their whole life into that, and really for me, my profound motivation, like the world title for me, was to give back to them, you know. Of course, like you can give your parents back money or buy them a house or this or that, but realistically, they're just seeing, this is like something that they'll take to their grave, you know, their emotions that we give them that day. So it's, and also I believe that, like, I'm just an athlete. I don't believe really in being overly talented. Maybe I do, that's a lie, but when you get to a high level in a sport, everybody's talented, you know, everybody trains hard. And so the only thing that separates like first place from second place from third place, other things, and especially the team, you know. And I believe, and I am creating the best team around me, and that when people ask me what my strength is, that really is my strength. You know, my strength is bringing amazing people around the table and to motivate them on a singular project, more so than whatever my strength's endurance or my FTP or this or that.
Yeah. There's a great bit at the end of the documentary where your brother Jake, your younger brother, says, well, I can't remember what it is. I've got 6 years or something to win the world championships now, to do it younger than he was. And I just think there's that scene, and there's a scene where you're standing at the side of the road cheering on the little kids at one of Jake's race and clapping them as it goes by. And I sort of think that's ultimately what this is all about. It's not about numbers on a page. It's about inspiring the next little generation of kids coming through to do the same thing that you've been inspired to do.
Yeah, for sure. And it's quite a difficult, I've asked myself this question quite a lot recently. So I feel in a slight dilemma, because on the one hand, like, kids, they want to do football, right? Because they see Ronaldo driving a Ferrari and with a really expensive watch on his wrist. But that's not what Cristiano Ronaldo is about. You know, that's an image he's giving. And it seems quite, when you see that, it looks quite selfish, you know? And so I could have bought it with the same mentality as, okay, I'm going to make this sport cool. I'm going to make kids want to do triathlon because they know they can buy an Aston Martin if they win Kona or this or that or that. It's not actually a selfish, it's almost selfless because you're basically exposing your life and everything you do to kind of inspire and be a hero. So it's a very weird situation, and I'm not saying I'm at all there, but at the moment I feel like I'm like, I don't know which direction to go in, if I should just kind of keep calm and quiet and enjoy my simple life, and in which case I might just go and I might win a world title or two more, etc. But I'll just go unnoticed, you know, I'll enjoy my life, but I might go unnoticed, or I take all these risks and I pursue my wildest dreams and kind of not show off, but just like really live my life to the fullest and show what you can achieve through triathlon. Because that's, at the end of the day, that is what inspires kids, you know? So it's a general question that I've been asking myself, and that it's the next step in me trying to find myself and where I bring my career.
Yeah, it sounds like you're going through that cycle a little bit of, you've aimed for this thing for literally your whole life, and now you've achieved it. It's the what's next? Which fork in the road do I take?
Mm, yeah, for sure, yeah. But I think for the first step of doing that is really to identify like who I am and what makes me happy, because you can very quickly get lost. And I had a period like that where after the World Champs, after living such a high, I kind of noticed that for two months, so it's been what, 3 and a bit months now, for 2 and a bit months, my mental health was going like down, and I was just not being a nice person. And I kind of expected a low after such a high, but in a different way, you know. And the low for me came more from I think when you're at the top, obviously everybody's, oh, you're amazing. It's amazing what you've done. And it's not a natural, it's not natural for a human to get that many praise, I don't believe. And this is why like mega celebrities like have these drug addictions or whatever, sometimes commit suicide, and obviously at a much, much lower scale. But you could feel a start of that where my ego just got too big. And I wasn't respecting anymore the people that were around me, my original team, you know. Because at the end of the day, they're the people who love me. It's not the fans or the sponsors, you know. The people who love me, you can count them on a hand or two, you know. So it took me a while to realize that, and I did. I hit some pretty dark places. Yeah, I'm not shy away.
And I want to ask you at this point, and this is a potentially a delicate subject. Something that might have played into this was in the immediate aftermath of Kona, there were some pretty serious allegations of drug use leveled at you on social media and in other places as well. Can you talk us through your reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this was a big factor as well. And I think you said after Kona, but it's been after Nice.
After Nice, yeah.
Yeah, it's been... That really didn't help, and the way it felt for me, or the way I describe it to people, is that I felt like for 15 years of my life, or pretty much my whole life, I'd been trying to build this like amazing villa, let's say, you know, and that like literally not even a month later, well, the next day pretty much, I built this villa, somebody just comes and like breaks it all, you know. That's what it felt like. And that's what's sad about it. Is that this is literally created from nothing or a few comments, you know, and often it's generated by jealousy. But there's some people in the world that just, I don't know, I think they feed off negative energy or something or conflict. But at the end of the day, I've come to realize that I can't control other people's opinion on me. You know? I know who I am, and I'll carry on doing what I'm doing. But it's a horrible situation, and I don't wish it on anybody. And the reason I reacted how I did, because I, again, that was like people it felt like people thought that I brought it to light. But the reason I brought it to light was because there's been many Ironman world champions before me, and pretty much all of them have had to do with some sort of allegations. It just goes unnoticed, you know, or not only the people in the community know it, but when you're an athlete, it's really difficult. And so I was like, well, these people are just accusing people freely. they should be punished just the same as the guy who cheats, basically. And so I didn't really care about exposing it because that's what I wanted to stop. I wanted there to be a system in place where you can't just, it's too easy. You know, I could go to a race, go to a world championship next year, and the day before the race or 2 days before the race saying, oh yeah, Gustav is taking this, that, and that. And that will affect his mental state like crazy. So it's just, I think people need to be a bit more careful about how freely we kind of press anything or rumors, or because at the end of the day, like, we're not doing anything crazy. You know, you and many people can run at 350 per kilometer. It's just how long can you hold it for? And many people, you can do 100 meters at 3 minutes. 50.
Yeah, maybe 50 meters.
50 meters, exactly. So all you need now is just to increase your aerobic capacity to do it for longer. And it's the same on the bike. Everybody can sprint at over 300 watts. It's just who can maintain it long. So I don't believe we're doing like these crazy, inhumane things. You know, I grew up believing that. Like I'd never, very early on, I got an opportunity to race like the best, whether it's Gomez, Crowley, Fredino, and I never like looked at them, thought, Jesus, like that seems inhumane what they're doing, you know. And I just, so I grew up with that belief that I could be better, and I believe the people who are accusing me don't believe that. And I've always said that I don't believe that the true greats are cheats, because you don't have that kind of mentality, you know? You don't have the mentality of looking for shortcuts. And at the end of the day, the people who are accusing me, and they are other pros that have, I don't know, they've listened to some random guy on the internet or whatever. They're kind of hiding behind that because deep down they know that they're not going to be the best in the world. And I can't do anything about that. I can't control that. And that was obviously difficult to swallow. And it wasn't even about me. It just felt so saddening for my family and my team, you know, because it's we've worked so hard for this. And for me to get a few like negative comments for it to explode like that. So yeah, anyway, that's the situation.
Yeah. Can you understand why people are suspicious given things that have happened in cycling? Can you understand why the general public kind of look at this and go, well, hang on, this, you know, Sam's effectively come from nowhere to win this. There must be something suspicious going on. What would your reaction to that be?
I genuinely believe the cycling days, obviously the early 2000s and all that didn't help. And then the case last year was like a real shock and a wake up call with Colin's case. And in some senses, or me personally, I'm really happy that the Colin case happened because we've been tested like way, way more.
Yeah. How often do you get tested as a pro?
I've been tested eight. I got my Adams file open next to me because we have to put the whereabouts like over 15 times this year.
Really?
And people don't realize like it's a lot of time and energy, because every single day you have to basically devote an hour of your life to being in a certain place and not forgetting to be there, you know? So there've been times where I've just like, I've gone out to a restaurant to watch a rugby match with my mates, and you get called and you can't go because when people just accuse you and you're devoting your devoting your life to also showing that you're clean and being equally, I don't want to be like, it looks even more suspicious, you know, if I'm there and I'm like, oh, well, here's my Adams. Look, I've never tested. And I could do this, you know, I could contact whatever WADA and show that there's never been any, not even variation in my blood work. So, and there was an email going around by Rudy Stab, which was just, it was just insane. Like, he's just making things up out of thin air. And so, he's had problems in the past, and all my partners are on my side, you know, because that was the big risk when I exposed it, was like, oh, maybe people saying, oh, I might lose sponsors, doesn't look good, etc. But it wasn't about me, it was about people just being a bit more careful. Now, I don't want the next world champion to be accused of doping when he's worked his whole life, you know, to achieve that.
Yeah, good. Well, thank you for answering those questions. So honestly, I really appreciate that. And I think a lot of people who are fans of the sport will appreciate it as well. On a happier note, I want to wrap this up with a couple of questions we've got for listeners, from listeners for you. So first up, Jason H says, how do you gauge how hard you go on the bike? Is there a limit you set yourself, or do you just go all guns out?
So I work a lot on heart rate during Ironman. Pretty much my whole race, or maybe apart from the start of the swim, I try and keep around 150 BPM my max is maybe around 185, if that gives a kind of perspective. Most of the time I try to aim for that, but then there's key moments in the race where you have to attack. And so I'm sure my heart rate when Clément attacked on the first climb, it was probably over 170. You know, and you have to take these risks. The main thing is probably not spending 4 or 5 minutes over your threshold, because then like you might not have enough like blood to your stomach and then nutrition might go wrong, etc. So you can kind of put short bursts in, but I would say if you're an age grouper, trying to fix or use your previous Ironmans as an example of kind of what your average heart rate is across the bike and across the run, and just try and aim for that basically. And sometimes after the swim, after the run in transition, it can take a bit of time to come back down. But generally after 10 or 15K or so, you should, aim for that heart rate, or that's what I do in this.
Nice. Dave B says, what was Sam's average power climbing the Col d'Acre? So there you go. That's put you on the spot. He wants actual numbers, Sam.
Because he sent me the questions before I checked, and it was around 370, 380. Close to an hour. It depends where you count the Col de l'Ecre on, because it starts pretty much down from the bottom all the way to the top.
Yeah.
380 watts.
Nice one. And finally, Stephen C says, have you got any tips for the Nice Ironman course? I'm doing it later this year. Please help.
I would say it's, to not, unlike I did, not get too excited on the first climb. Because it's a much longer bike course, you know, it's like 25 minutes more for me, but obviously that time is exponential if you're spending more time on course. So it could be 50 minutes or an hour more, but for some people, and there isn't that many aid stations compared to some Ironman. So making sure you don't lose your bottles, or keeping hydrated, because also when it's technical and you're kind of looking up the road, et cetera, you don't think about hydration. So I would say, making sure you hit all the aid stations and kind of putting on your Garmin or on a bit of paper on your bike, like when to take the nutrition and just being religious about it. The run is pretty straightforward. There's lots of aid stations but it's very mentally difficult because it's just out and back and it feels like a straight line that goes on forever. So be prepared mentally for the run.
I found that really hard when you turn around at the airport and you can see the dome on top of the casino at the finish line, and it looks like it's the end of the earth, doesn't it? It's only 5K away, but
it can be very hot as well. If he's racing in July, June, July? It can, especially on the promenade, it can feel like 40 degrees there. Yeah.
Great. Hey, well, listen, just to wrap this up then, what's the plan for the rest of the year for you? Looking forward into the rest of this racing year.
The rest of the year, just Christmas Christmas and a bit of training. Next year, it's been difficult because it's a good position to be in, but all the different brands, Ironman and PTO and Challenger, all investing more into the athletes, which is good to see. But as I said, there's more and more money in the sport, and it can be difficult to do everything. There's so many races now. So for me, my goal is obviously still Kona. And then around that, it's still not sure because the PTO are putting in place like a system where they pay their athletes to race a certain amount of races, etc. Like kind of like a contract. And Ironman, don't do that, but you might think, okay, I'm going to chase the Ironman Pro Series. So yeah, still a lot of questions, but ideally I'd like to race everywhere, but you need to the way I look at it is, okay, I've got 315 days or something to Kona, and what am I going to do to be best possible shape there, and whatever races will happen before that, I'll let people know on my lovely website. Girlfriend made for me.
Last question, going flat out, and if everything went perfectly on a course like Roth, how fast do you think you could go?
Over the whole distance? It's a good question. The thing is, Rough, have you raced Rough?
No.
It's really not flat. Like it's incredible how fast we go on the bike, considering it's actually like really hard and always on and off the power. So, and the run is slightly short there. So it depends how you measure it. I'm going to completely not answer your question. I believe it's possible to ride under 4 hours in Kona, and I want to do that. I guess in an optimal situation, you could swim 46:30 or something. So I'm going to get my calculator out. 46 plus, let's say 3:55. So that's, plus a marathon in 2 hours 35. So my dad and me still believe that I can improve more on my cycling than like the Norwegians' philosophies. They believe they can like run 2:25, you know, and gain like 5 to 10 minutes there. My dad and me believe I can do that more on the bike and carry on kind of slowly progressing on the run. I believe 2:35 in an optimal world. So that would be 2 times 16.
That'd be 7:15. Somewhere around the mark.
That'd be 426 minutes. So that's devised 426 minutes divided by 60 is 7.1. So that's like, yeah, that's really, really fast.
7:06, isn't it?
Forget that. I don't think 7:06. No, yeah, 7:06. Yeah. No, yeah. What did Magnus do in Ross? 7:24 or 7:28?
24, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think Magnus and me on a good day could go under.
That's what I want to see. I want to see you and Magnus on the bike, out of the swim together, on the bike together, and then a foot race at Roth.
No, that's the last time I'm coming out of the swim with Magnus.
Yeah, love it. Listen, Sam, thank you very much for your time on the interview today, and congratulations again. I'd encourage everyone listening to go and watch your documentary, which is on YouTube, and it's titled Look, Mum, I Can Fly.
That's the one, yeah. But then later I realized that Travis Scott, the singer, has the same documentary called Look, Mum, I Can Fly. But it's Look, Mum, like M-O-M, mine's M-U-M, just if people can't find it.
And tell us your website and your Instagram so people can go and check out more about you.
Website is Sam Laidlow, and Instagram is also Sam Laidlow, so pretty easy.
Well, listen, thanks very much for being true to your word. And back in 2019, you said, when I'm Ironman World Champion, I'll come back on, and here we are. So on behalf of me and all the listeners, congratulations. We look forward to watching what evolves over the next 2 decades.
Thanks a lot, mate. Appreciate it.
Well, I hope you really enjoyed that interview with Sam Laidlow there. I think he was good to his word. He came on, he was honest, he didn't dodge the difficult questions. I'd sat down with him beforehand and said, look, I really want to address some of these allegations that have been put towards you, and let's address them. And he was fully up for it right from the start. So full credit to him. And I hope you gained a lot from listening to that interview overall. So to wrap this up, here are some discount codes and deals for you. At precisionfuelandhydration.com, you can use the code OA23 for 15% off your first electrolyte order. And you can head to their website. You can use the free fuel and hydration planning tool to receive a personalized strategy for your next race. You heard Sam there talking about the importance of, in his case, racing Ironman Nice, planning your hydration and planning your calories, planning where you're going to take them. The first part of that is knowing how much sodium, how much fluid, and how many grams of carbs you can have per hour and that you tolerate. So the fuel and hydration planning tool over on the PFNH website is the first stop for that. That'll really help you understand what's right for you, your body, the conditions you're racing in or the conditions you're training in, and the events that you want to do. So basically, you can refine your strategy in training, and then you can deliver it on race day. You can also book a free one-to-one video consultation with PFNH's athlete support team, and they'll be happy to help you nail your race nutrition plan and then perform your best on race day. And remember, over at teamoxygenaddict.com, I think we've got the most comprehensive endurance sports coaching program for busy age groupers. If you've been a long-term listener of the show and you've been sitting there for a while thinking, do you know what, I really think I could do some help with my training and really get some coaching going into the next season, now is the perfect time as we're starting a new season. It's the perfect time to explore coaching and find out the difference that it can make for you. The one big difference that I think we make to athletes with our coaching is we take away the worry of the training on a day-to-day basis. You no longer have to think what you're going to do on a day-to-day basis, or worry that what you're doing is right or not, or wonder whether you should be doing a different kind of training session. The one thing that I offer, if I had to sum it up, is we take away that doubt from an athlete's mind and allow you just to concentrate on the business of getting your training session done, and then get back to your family life, your work life, your hobbies, and it's all taken care of. And if you can get the training done that we set you, guarantee you'll be in excellent shape for whichever race you choose to enter. So if you want to find out more, click a link in the show notes and we'll have a chat with you and we can just go from there. All right then. So remember, there's links in the show notes on YouTube or on podcast player of your choice. You don't have to remember them. Just go through and click and it goes right through to our calendar, or it goes right through to PFNH. And until next week, have a great, safe training and racing week. I'm Coach Rob Wilby, and you've been listening to the Oxygen Addict Podcast.